This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
So over to you now for questions. Could you just indicate how many people want to ask questions at this stage? Just get a feel for certainly one, two. Could you stand up, say who you are? There is a microphone, so your wise question will be captured forever.
Cherry Bartlett, Programme Lead for End-of-Life Care in Advanced Kidney Disease. We've got some projects going, and I was very interested in what you said about the GPs and their confidence, because in the renal centre, the nephrologists are lacking confidence about taking this advanced care planning forward. And I'm just wondering if the material would be suitable for them as well.
Test it and see. We'll try it. I think that's going to be the message. We've just finished putting the GP evaluation survey together, so that will be freely available very, very soon. Happy to give you that and the materials they used and try it and see.
I'm sure you're right about quite a lot of renal physicians lacking confidence, but I would also say that renal physicians are one of the groups that have probably responded most positively to the end-of-life care strategy, and there's a lot of work been going on with them. I think partly because, as you will know, they face particular challenges. The challenge of, do I start dialysis for this patient or do I not? And if the decision is no, then there is an inevitability about what the consequence will be, and an even shorter term consequence if you decide to stop dialysis. So I think it is in the front of their minds in a way that some other clinicians, it isn't quite as much in the front of their minds, and I would perhaps wish it was.
When the patients are on dialysis, but the surprise question answer comes up, no, or whatever, and they feel as though they are letting that patient down, because they were their only hope.
They've
got the really bad news to tell them, and they're finding it extremely difficult.
And I think this is again where we, step one in the pathway is not only about identifying the patients, which I think the renal physicians probably do, but then actually giving them the confidence and competence to know how to have those conversations, and so to feel. I mean, they're never easy conversations, but at least if you can feel you've done it as well as you might, then you can come out of those conversations feeling that was a job reasonably well done. And, from my clinical days as a cancer clinician, I know that sometimes I got it reasonably right and sometimes I probably didn't. At the end of a clinic in the afternoon, when you've had to have those conversations three or four times, you come out feeling better if you think, well, at least I've done it as well as I could. But I think we've all got things to learn.
May I ask a second quick question?
No. if there's time at the end. If there's time at the end.
Hello, David Oliver, consultant at the Wisdom Hospice in Rochester. I have great concerns that are we all talking about the same thing? We have end-of-life care, palliative care, specialist palliative care, hospice care, and now dedicated palliative care. And I have great concerns that people talk to each other, meaning talking about completely different things. Certainly in our area, the commissioners talk about end-of-life care, and if you push them, they're talking about the last few days. And when we keep saying, but there's more to end-of-life care than that, it's very difficult. So I don't know how you feel we try to get people talking about the same thing.
Well, we have tried very hard to make it clear that the end-of-life care strategy is not just about the last few days, partly by saying, look, the last few days is step 5 out of 6, which, you should make people realise that steps 1 to 4 come before that. And we've always talked about it being months or even years sometimes that the end-of-life care pathway needs to cover. I think we all recognise the very clear role of specialist palliative care within end-of-life care, but we've also said that it's like a pyramid, and that is a relatively small number of people. When we last calculated, it was about 5,500 people who were dedicating effectively the whole of their working life to this. And then there were a whole raft of others, there's the 36,000 GPs and, who are doing end-of-life care as part of their role, and we wanted to make sure that was recognised too. But it's not easy to get these messages across.
Good quick comment?
I think just briefly, you're right. There is a confusing, conflicting terminology that gets used around this whole agenda. I think that one of the opportunities we've got is with the government's new focus on outcomes and quality, that actually we can remind commissioners and policymakers and decision makers that actually what we're talking about is the quality of care of people who are dying, whenever that may be, however that may be, whatever their needs may be. And so if we focus on quality and the outcomes and the integration of services and the holistic approach to meeting those needs, we won't go too far wrong.
Thank you. One more question.
I'm Dr. Jackie Morris. I'm British Geriatric Society Dignity Champion, and welcome everything that everybody said. I still have concerns that there is so much out there to inform people, but yet it doesn't happen in reality. And as a geriatrician, I've been told by my colleagues that they don't want to be called Dr. Death. They are worried that they don't have enough time to talk to people and have these difficult conversations. And I still see people who have multiple metastases from, say, CA breast, who nobody has actually sat down with the family or with them to discuss their prognosis and life plan. And I talked to a family last week or the week before, and the family said, well, we're having conversations amongst ourselves, but we haven't talked about it to mum yet. And which is worrying. And finally, I would rather use the term frailty, which is the term which geriatricians are quite happy with, rather than multiple comorbidities. And most of the public really know what frailty means, and geriatricians know what frailty means, and we're happy with that. And that is actually much more, slightly more focused, and Linda Free did a wonderful definition of frailty. So that's how we've got the information out there. How do we get it, make it a reality? Thank you.
Well, we could spend the rest of the day discussing that, Mike's got 30 seconds.
My 30-second view on it is that I think it very much focuses on the fact that we want to take both a hospital focus on this as well as a care home focus, as well as a primary care focus. The routes to success in hospitals is one of this. We've got to build the momentum of saying, okay, who are the clinical groups we most need to work with? And, of course, geriatricians would be amongst those. Of course, oncologists would be. Of course, renal physicians would be. And you can start saying, who are the groups that we really know we need to work with? And then we need to work with them and say, how can we make this sufficiently comfortable for you that you don't back away from it? But we're not there yet.
I can assure you, having spoken quite a lot in America, we were actually quite far ahead in terms of talking about these issues. But obviously lots to do. One more final question.
Thank you. Biwi, President of the Association for Palliative Medicine for Great Britain and Ireland. The question, I suppose, is really directed to Jonathan to start with, and that is, you've talked about the plurality of services and, you know, the brave new world that's coming in and so on, and I'm interested that there was a whole sector that wasn't mentioned at all, which is the hospice services provided by NHS organisations, and I wonder what plans you have to make sure that that group doesn't get disenfranchised, destabilised or paralysed. Thank you.
I think that's a very good question, and we know that in this brave new world, those services are coming under quite a lot of pressure in terms of how they will be organised in the future and how they will be resourced and whether they'll continue to be a part of the NHS family in its current form or whether they'll go down a slightly different route. But I think. What sits behind your question is a sentiment that I think I would share completely, that this isn't about what type of organisation is providing the service or what its governance structure actually is and how it's constituted. This is about recognising we have expertise, we have knowledge and we have skill throughout the system, that we need to work together in a coordinated, integrated way to spread throughout the wider health and social care system. So I think you're absolutely right to highlight the important contribution, the vital contribution that NHS hospices in particular make within their communities.
Thank you. I think we do need to break for coffee. If there are any questions, then those of the panel that are around, please harangue them. See you back at 11:40 promptly. Thank you.